Listen, there's a great work to be done. As soon as you win this court battle, you must deliver this message. Take advantage of this opportunity and declare a powerful message to this world. He expects more of us. He believes we can do more. Who's going to stop Christ? Who's going to stop Christ from getting this work done?
This is Behind the Work.
Welcome to Behind the Work. I'm Grant Turgeon. We're actually recording this program today from the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma, on Friday, March 22nd. And by the time you hear this on Monday, March 25th, the Pastor General of the Philadelphia Church of God, Mr. Gerald Fleury, the Western United States Regional Director, Mr. Brian Davis, and a couple other staff members will already be up in Portland, Oregon, where Mr. Fleury will be hosting a two-day personal appearance campaign. The first lecture is on Sunday afternoon, and the second one is on Monday evening. So with that being a really important event that is taking place in the work right now, I thought I would just get into some of the history of God's work in Oregon. This is an area rich with Philadelphia-era history. So many incredible things happened in God's work in Oregon with Herbert W. Armstrong. This was the place where a relative challenged him and called him ignorant because he didn't believe in evolution. This is a place where his wife at the same time was challenging him about why he should keep the Sabbath day. And so obviously a couple of women in his life challenging him like this made him very upset. He didn't want to be told he was a fool for not believing the same things they did. And so he set about trying to disprove evolution, but at the same time also disproving the Sabbath day. He was right when it came to evolution, but very wrong when it came to the Sabbath day. He spent six months of night and day study at the Portland Public Library to try to prove these beliefs for himself. I actually had the chance a few years ago to visit that very same library. Just a really exciting experience. A big, beautiful library. A lot of finely polished wood on the inside and several stories, large staircases. Just a beautiful building. And it was pretty exciting to imagine Mr. Armstrong spending so much time up there. And really, basically all day, he would be in the library until it closed, and they basically had to tell him it was time to leave every night. And then first thing in the morning, once again, he'd go back in there. And the reason he had all this time to do this is because right before he moved up to Oregon in the summer of 1924, his advertising business had actually collapsed. So this was the start of God really humbling him. Mr. Armstrong was truly a high-class human being, a hard worker who really did make quite a success of himself in this physical world. And, of course, along with success, a lot of the time comes money, and along with money comes recognition. And it can be easy to get materialistic in a situation like that. It can be easy to become self-reliant rather than relying on God. And so over the course of many years, God started to change his mind. God really started to work with Mr. Armstrong, and he had to humble Mr. Armstrong. Really, we need humbling, especially when we become as great as Mr. Armstrong did. And he became great at such a young age. That would be hard for any of us to deal with. That would be hard to stay humble when we achieve the great heights that he did. So God humbled Mr. Armstrong. His advertising business collapsed seemingly overnight due to forces beyond his control. So he moved up to Oregon where he had family and decided to basically go up there with his wife and try to rebuild his life. And yet when he was up there, he tried to establish a business basically selling different clay products. And that started to work pretty well, and he was doing a pretty good job. A little while later, he thought, at least, of putting God first, praying and studying, doing it enough time throughout the day, he thought. And yet, that business collapsed as well. So he definitely had to go through some really tough trials before he moved up to Oregon in 1924, and then after that as well. At one point, his family endured 28 years of poverty, too. So he really went through just some trials that would probably cause most of us to just fall apart. And yet he never gave up. That was a quality that God saw in Mr. Armstrong that definitely would be put to good use later on in doing the work. So Mr. Armstrong, as soon as he got up to Oregon, was dealing with this challenge. He was dealing with all this extra time he had because his business had fallen apart and he didn't have a job for a while. So he was at the library night and day studying evolution, studying the Sabbath, and proving those things. Once he had to go admit to his wife that she was right, he really started to question all of his religious beliefs. Not just the Sabbath day anymore, but every doctrine. And he went about the long, intensive task of studying the doctrines one at a time, proving those doctrines one at a time. He spoke to leading ministers of the Baptists, the Quakers, the Seventh-day Adventists, and he asked them questions that seemed to stump all of them. They couldn't answer his biblical questions. He just wanted to know the truth, and sometimes he would even write out papers or articles that would prove certain doctrines. For example, that when Israel is mentioned in the Bible, it is referring primarily to the modern nations of the United States and Britain. He proved that in detail and presented that to a minister at a nearby church. And while that person admitted that every bit of it was true, they still could not actually go along with it. Mr. Armstrong realized through those experiences that ministers in the world basically have to teach whatever their congregations want them to teach. They are subject to the whims of their congregations. They don't have full rein to just go ahead and preach what is true. Even if they learn that they are wrong on something, they can't just change it right away because that could upset the people who are attending their congregations, which in turn could affect how much money they are making. So that's another lesson Mr. Armstrong learned up in Oregon. He had to understand that if he was going to devote his life to God, he could not be at the mercy of human beings who were paying him. And he learned this over the course of many years, where for a long time he had to walk to Sabbath services. For a long time, he had to interact with various Sabbath-keeping people in the area, but he couldn't get paid by any of them, and he wasn't even a member of some of those churches, even though he had some interactions. It seemed like this was during the Sardis era of the church, which was an era that the book of Revelation describes as being spiritually dead. So Mr. Armstrong could see parts of the truth in certain churches, but they didn't really have the right government structure. They didn't really seem like they had a common purpose to strive for. So basically, they weren't doing a work. And so for a long time, Mr. Armstrong didn't even bother becoming a member. But after a while, Mr. Armstrong, after he realized that he had been absolutely right on evolution and absolutely wrong on the Sabbath day, worked hard to figure out which of his other beliefs were true and which of them were false. And this led him to eventually just submit totally to God. He realized that everything that he had believed from the time he was very young basically was just a result of the way he was raised, the family environment, the outside environment that affected him. And that didn't really mean that it was true. It just was something that he had always been around and assumed was correct. He had to basically put away those wrong ideas. As Mr. Fleury said on a Key of David program he recorded this week, he had to rip out the tree of wrong ideas from his mind. These ideas that had taken place and that he had just unquestioningly accepted from basically the time he was born had to be torn out because they were wrong. Mr. Armstrong had to go through that, and it was a very painful process. He describes it in his autobiography, which you can get for free at thetrumpet.com, as just basically being completely defeated, just being crushed. It was a painful experience for him, and yet something that really did change his life for the better. And he was always so thankful that God had put him through these trials that finally forced him to realize where he was wrong and how he could start to finally live the abundant life. Mr. Armstrong experienced so many other things up in Oregon. He had one instance where his wife was deathly ill. I believe that was because she had a lack of iron in her blood. And so Mr. Armstrong knew that he needed God's help with this. He had several other things, including not knowing where his next meal would come from, having an overcoat that had a hole in it, a few other things as well. And basically what he did was utter an 18-second prayer for help, and God answered that immediately. He provided, I believe it was all six of the specific requests that Mr. Armstrong had made. So Mr. Armstrong realized while he was up in Oregon that God truly does answer prayers. But it wasn't just a result of that 18-second prayer. This was something that happened because he had gotten close to God. He had been conquered by God, and he was close to God every day. It was because he cried out to God in prayer all the time that God would answer a short prayer like that too. I believe in that prayer, Mr. Armstrong even said, "Anything else I'm not thinking of right now, please provide that as well. Anything I need that I'm not even remembering to ask you for, please provide that too." And God did answer every detail. Mr. Armstrong, while he was up in Oregon, also understood the power of healing, not even just from his wife's experience, but also from some people that he met at a big a healing convention. Basically, this was someone who claimed to be some sort of a magical healer, and he went to see what that really was all about. He met a couple there. One man had a couple of pretty bad health problems, and Mr. Armstrong, not even being ordained a minister yet, knew how to pray, and he knew how to ask for God and truly believe in what he was asking, and he was able to witness this man being healed because of Mr. Armstrong praying for him a couple of times. There are a lot of just really fantastic stories in the autobiography like this. I believe it starts in chapter 16 where he first moves. Actually, chapter 15, the end of that chapter is where he, or maybe end of chapter 14, that's right. He moves up to Oregon at the end of chapter 14. And then all the way through, it's at least a couple hundred pages here in the book. Yeah, it just keeps on. It's a very big section of the book, I'll say that, that just has to do with God's work through Mr. Armstrong in Oregon. Basically starts around page 220 and goes all the way up into the mid-500s of this book, just showing what led Mr. Armstrong to pursuing the abundant life, to pursuing a life of oneness with God. And he learned, I believe it was even after 7 years of keeping the holy days without knowing their real meaning, God finally revealed the meaning of that to him. So it just seemed like in every way God was testing Mr. Armstrong's obedience and seeing how he would respond to that. Up in Oregon also is where Mr. Armstrong found the prayer rock. He was at the Fisher Farm. He found this rock back out behind the farmhouse, and when he would go for his walks in the mornings, he would stop by there, and it was a private place. It just happened to be the perfect little rock that he could kneel in front of and then rest his elbows on in the prayer position, and this was a place where he could be in peace and privacy and really connect with God directly, and because he was also conducting some evangelistic campaigns at this time, he drew on a lot of power. He had to really have God's words flowing through him at these campaigns. He couldn't be speaking his own words. He couldn't just be relying on his own human wisdom to speak with these people who wanted to know God's truth. It had to be coming from God. It had to be inspired by God. And so Mr. Armstrong drew a lot of power from this prayer rock. It helped him deal with hecklers at these meetings. There were people, local ministers, who challenged him there. There was an elderly man who would come by the meetings, and he had already stumped all the other local ministers of other denominations. He had already basically dismantled their fledgling belief systems, and he wanted to do the same thing to Mr. Armstrong. His name in the book here, you can find him. His name is Mr. Belshaw, and he basically wanted to humiliate Mr. Armstrong in front of all these people who showed up to these campaigns. So he would stand up, he'd bellow out a question, he'd be talking about, he basically tried to convince the audience that God's law is done away and that it's all about grace and no longer do you have to obey the law. And again, it wasn't just Mr. Belshaw, it was other ministers. In one case, a minister who gave an opening prayer for the lecture tried to use his prayer time to discredit the subject Mr. Armstrong was about to speak on that night. So he definitely encountered a lot of opposition. Even among some members of the Sardis era, he encountered some hostility because a lot of the ministers didn't like him very much. So a lot of trials there, but definitely he learned some really powerful lessons from all of that. Chapter 30 is titled "The World Tomorrow Broadcast Begins," and this just shows you, gives you an idea of how small the work started. He had a really short radio spot on this tiny radio station up in Oregon. And at that time, he didn't really have any funding for these broadcasts. He really just had to go about this endeavor in faith. Here's what it says on page 430 of the autobiography. Let's see. In September, this is 1933. In September, very soon after rejecting a salary and being controlled and muzzled by men, the living Christ began opening doors for the mass proclaiming of his gospel. It was then that someone brought to my attention the fact that the local radio station at Eugene, KORE, then the very smallest minimum power of 100 watts, had a morning devotional program scheduled, but that they were having difficulty getting local ministers to conduct the program. It was free time, carried by the station as a public service sustaining program of 15 minutes, 7:45 to 8 a.m. Immediately, I went to the radio station. A woman secretary told me she felt sure they would be glad to have me take the program for a week. I was to call back later for the exact date. On my second call, I was assigned the week of October 9th. October 9th was surely a great big day in my life, the day of my very first experience before a microphone, on the air. I took this opportunity very seriously. It was an opportunity to speak to several hundred people at once. I had never spoken to that many before. I spent the preceding week preparing rather extensive notes and script. I might never again have such an opportunity, so I decided to strike directly at the very heart of the gospel of the kingdom of God. Since the kingdom of God is based on the promises made to Abraham, I began on Monday morning's program with the promises made to Abraham. And then he goes on to talk about what they call mic fright. This is something that happens to probably everyone, at least the first time that they go on radio. It's certainly happened to me, where maybe I have so much to say while I'm in the studio, but then as soon as we go live, your breath shortens. You start breathing really hard, but in quick bursts, and it's hard to formulate your thoughts. It's easy to freeze in the middle of a sentence and forget what you were even talking about. So mic fright, being afraid of being in front of the microphone. I also experience this a lot when I have to interview people. Thankfully, the interviews that I've done live on the radio have gone really well. But when I go out to a certain activity or something and try to collect some interviews, it is difficult to find people who really want to speak in a situation like that, which is understandable. And Mr. Armstrong talks about here how he got a surprising response from the radio program that he had. He had 14 letters and telephone calls requesting copies of the messages that he had broadcast. And he actually received an idea at that moment to start the World Tomorrow program. So that all started with a 15-minute broadcast on a tiny radio station in Eugene, Oregon. And it's important to remember, too, that at first Mr. Armstrong didn't realize just how big God's plans were for him. He didn't understand that he was not just going to broadcast or deliver God's truth to a really small section of Oregon. Eventually, Mr. Armstrong's horizons were broadened to where he realized, maybe I need to deliver the message to the entire state. And then he really started thinking big and thought, what about the entire Pacific Northwest? That's where I need to expand this message to. But then at some point soon after, he was actually down in California. So obviously it couldn't have just been the Pacific Northwest. At some point he realized it was going to go not just to all of America, all of North America, but around the entire world. To the point where if you asked anyone in the 1970s or 1980s who Mr. Armstrong was, chances are they knew who he was, or they knew someone who knew who he was. The message really did get out there in power, and he fulfilled many prophecies in the Bible about delivering the gospel message around the world. And then chapter 31, starting on page 434, talks about the plain truth being published. And that started very small as well. And the way it started is really interesting because years before this, the plain truth began in 1934, but basically back in 1927, he had this idea. So this was an idea that was at the back of his mind for about 7 years. It says here, page 438, back in 1927, I had made up an entire dummy of this proposed magazine. I had even written articles for it. I even had a professional letter artist design a front cover idea in 1927, and I had tried designing one myself. But we had never had the wherewithal to start publishing a magazine. This ambition to publish The Plain Truth was the natural outgrowth of earlier business experience. Much of my 20 years of advertising experience had been spent in the class magazine field. Now, at last, I realized that this magazine was a must as a follow-up for the radio broadcast. Yet we were no more able financially than we had been in 1927. Necessity is the mother of invention. If we could not afford to publish a high-quality, professional-appearing magazine, I would simply convert the mimeographed bulletin I had been issuing for our scattered church brethren in the Willamette Valley into The Plain Truth. My idea for this magazine from the start had been to publish a magazine, not for church members, but for the general public, the unconverted and unchurched, an evangelistic-type publication to bring to the world God's truth, making it plain. So it started with 250 copies produced by hand on a mimeograph, and he compared that to the grain of a mustard seed, which is the smallest of all seeds, but it does grow to a size beyond what we would ever expect. So these are just some things that Mr. Armstrong did while he was up in Oregon, some lessons he learned up in Oregon. And to this day, the entire Pacific Northwest region especially is full of people who have been impacted by Mr. Armstrong's work. A lot of them obviously are not attending with the Philadelphia Church of God right now, but hopefully a lot of them are able to attend at this Portland campaign, which by the time you hear this, we'll be in the middle of. And definitely a message needs to get out to these people. It's no surprise that in the places where Mr. Armstrong did such a powerful work, you have some of the most insane and horrifying problems in the country today. Up in Portland, Oregon, I've been there, and there's basically homeless encampments everywhere you turn, especially under a lot of bridges. They have obviously some big drug problems. They've been at the center of a lot of these riots between Antifa and supporters of President Trump. just rioting in the streets, complete defiance of law enforcement. If you look down in Los Angeles, which is the area where Mr. Armstrong first established Ambassador College, 55,000 homeless people live in Los Angeles. They have horrifying problems, and Los Angeles is also the place where Hollywood dwells. That is where the Hollywood elites live, insulated from the rest of the common men, but they do decide that they should be lecturing the rest of us how we should live. So definitely some big problems in both areas where Mr. Armstrong started the work. Very small in Oregon, and then expanding beyond imagination down in Los Angeles. Those areas have been just ravaged by demonic presence, and there's no coincidence to that. So like I said, we're in the midst of this Portland, Oregon personal appearance campaign by PCG Pastor General, Key of David presenter, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury. And next week on the program, we will be giving you some details, hopefully some insider information about that Portland campaign. Thank you very much for listening today. This has been Behind the Work.
You've been listening to Behind the Work. Email your thoughts to comments at kpcg.fm. Listen for a new episode each Monday at 11:30 a.m. Central Time.